Session number 6042, reel 13.
And that was my sort of fetish is satisfied. I did it again 2 weeks later, but inflation had become so rampant that I got 2,000 yuan from my Japanese army clothing, quite identical, another lot, and the tin of milk also cost me 2,000 yuan. So in a fortnight there'd been 1,000% inflation. But it didn't matter. At that time, with one US dollar you could buy a Leica camera out of Japanese army looted stores. For a dollar you could get a pair of Zeiss binoculars. And of course most people were having a heyday looting Japanese souvenirs like rifles, swords, machine guns. One day I was at Fiangten Station, that's one of the big railway stations in Mukden, watching a Russian troop train come in. And it turned out to be an anti-tank regiment who'd come all the way from Germany across the Trans-Siberian Railway. And the men and the women who were the crews of who were the anti-tank regiment were completely integrated. They were mixed up in these goods vans that they'd travelled in. They hadn't got any passenger vehicles, and their guns were on flat cars mixed up with the vans. And there was a Russian lieutenant on the platform. He was obviously a sort of railway transport officer. And coming up from behind us were a lot of Japanese prisoners of war that the Russians had taken. And they were bringing them onto the platform to put them on a train. And I said to this, I'd got an American with me who was Russian-born, Nick Mihailov. And I said to Nick, here's our chance to get some sabres and souvenirs, Nick. And he said in Russian to the Russian lieutenant, what about some sabres off this lot of Japanese prisoners who were still armed? They'd taken their rifles off them, but they were still left with their sabres and bayonets. And he called over a Japanese lieutenant, and he ordered him to hand his sabre to me. I wasn't very popular, by the way, with the Japanese, but he was going to lose it anyway. So I had that off this Japanese lieutenant. And then another one was called up, and Nick Mihailov got that one, and Philip Christie, who was with me, he got another one. Well, generally, we did a sort of mild rampaging round Mukden. I suppose the most important historic event for me, personally, was that the Russians took over a huge European-type hotel in the town that the Japanese had built during their occupation. It was called the Yamato. It was built entirely on European, come French lines, even to having bidets in the bedrooms. The Yamato, by the way, is an old name for Japan. And the Russian high command took it for their headquarters for Manchuria. And one day I was by there, it stood in the middle of a great square, and a Russian sergeant to whom we were talking, we often went out with this American, Nick Mihailov, who was a pilot in the US Army Air Force, shot down in the Philippines. We saw this top brass coming down the steps to this hotel, and we said to this sergeant we were talking to, or he said it, because I couldn't speak Russian, who's that? And he said, Marshal Malinovsky. Now, Marshal Malinovsky ultimately became, later in history, became Minister of Defence. And we rushed over, and we were short of things like paper, but we'd got a lot of Camel's cigarettes, we'd had millions of Camel cigarettes dropped. And I quickly whipped off the paper off my Camel packet, as did Nick and Philip Christie. And we walked up the steps, gave a great salute to Malinovsky, and asked him for his autograph. And he answered our salute, but gave us the quick brush off and ordered his aide-de-camp to give us his autograph. And I've still got it to this day. Captain Kosprachovsky. And I've still got it in my album. But there was the mighty Malinovsky. Whilst we were there, Malinovsky was the army commander. He was then a marshal. And of course he was fresh from his victory over the Germans. And a couple of days later, we were advised by the Russian liaison officer, this woman captain, that Malinovsky had been joined by the new marshal who was going to be GOC Manchuria. And that was none other than Marshal of the Soviet Union, Vasilevsky. And we saw them together one day by the Yamato Hotel. But I'm taking up a lot of this tape on this banter. The Russians created some obstacles in getting us away. Whether the deliberate or otherwise, I don't know. But the Americans were pressing the Russians to provide the means of getting us to a port. They'd given up hope of getting the Russians to agree to bringing in transport planes. And finally, the Russians agreed. We knew all of this intimately because Colonel Donovan of the OSS, who'd come to live with us, was keeping us informed of all these negotiations. And when he'd come in, he'd brought some very high-powered radio equipment with him. One of the uses of it had been we were all allowed to send one radiogram home. And I still have mine. My mother kept it. And what does it say? It was a standard message. I'm safe in Mukden. And that was the message. But, of course, they got to send for thousands, so they couldn't clutter the airwaves. And Colonel Donovan was in close touch with the American High Command. And finally, he had everyone on parade and said, I've got some good news for you. The Russians have agreed with the American Commander-in-Chief that in the next few days they will make two trains available to take us to Dairen, to take you to Dairen, because he was staying there to clear up the debris. Dairen, which is on the peninsula near Port Arthur, of Russo-Japanese war fame, where a small American flotilla will come to pick you up. And around the 8th or 9th of September, or 10th of September, because we're well past the end of the war by now, we boarded. We were two train loads, big train loads. We went down to Fengten station, and in two batches, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, and I was in the officer's batch. We boarded some third-class wooden coaches, and after about a 15-hour train journey, it wasn't that far, but it was 15 hours, all through the night and part of the next morning, hair-raising, because the Japanese had run out of oil, so the maintenance on the track and the locomotives and the wheels was bad, so we went very slowly until an American lieutenant who was drunk on vodka given him by a Russian officer who was aboard. He went and took over the train at gunpoint. The train was being driven by a Japanese. He took over the train at gunpoint and opened the regulator, and we were going like a bat out of bloody hell till he could be restrained by another American climbing over and slowing the train down. And finally, we pulled into, as darkness was falling, we pulled into the good sidings of the docks of Dairen. And just as we pulled in through the sort of gates of this huge marshalling yard, which was so deserted due to the American blockade, the train went off the lines. We were only doing about 4 miles an hour because we were in a shunting area. The locomotive went off the lines, so we gave it up as a bad job and said, someone else can sort that out. We got off the train, and as we turned round the corner of a building, there was the most splendid sight in the world, the United States Navy hospital ship Relief. Of course, all a proper hospital ship, white, with the red crosses on the side and the red crosses on the funnel, and in accordance with international law, it is all illuminated. And I thought it was a very aptly named ship. So we couldn't wait. People started walking faster and faster and faster and then running. And by this time we'd got a lot of gear because we'd had these mountains showered on us by the planes. People had got all sorts of souvenirs. But they made the speed and they got to the dockside where, quite rightly, here was the Relief and in front of it was a United States naval transport, the Colbert. And tied up on the opposite docks were four American destroyer minesweepers. Because apparently the Yellow Sea, through which they'd had to come, had been heavily mined by aircraft and submarines in the closing months of the war, and they hadn't been swept. So to get the two ships, this is why the Americans wanted to fly us out, because they didn't want to risk their ships in the Yellow Sea till they'd properly cleared it. We were detailed to the relief. The Colbert, which is a big transport, was for the second train load, which was following us, you know, a few hours away. And of course, they didn't allow us immediately on board. We all had to go through a delousing and a fumigation station, which the Navy had set up. And then they tried to persuade you to throw away all the clothes you were wearing, which I was not reluctant to do because I'd got a load of junk, but some of the top officers had got some of their original clothing. They didn't force it on you, but if you wanted to keep your clothing, you'd all got to go through this fumigation, delousing process. And finally, I got on board the Relief, and there were American sailors waiting there to carry everything for you, even down to your haversack. Of course, it was rather amusing because a lot of the prisoners wouldn't let anything go out of their possession because they'd had 3.5 years of thieving and crookery. And, you know, these American sailors, wishing to relieve everyone of any work, practically dragged some of this stuff off people. And we were each shown to respective wards. I was taken to what normally in the ship's use would have been the surgical ward. And two very charming nurses, Thelma Hood and Lois Bagwell, I still keep in touch with them today, allocated beds to us, and we settled down for the trip, which we were told was to Okinawa, where we were to get off the Relief, which was going to be used to fetch more prisoners of war from other places. But as we approached Okinawa, and we dropped anchor in Buckner Bay, Okinawa, and they had the famous typhoon warning. It's a historic typhoon that occurred at that time of the year, at that period in history. And all shipping in Buckner Bay was ordered to leave and just sail away in a particular direction, I can't remember which. And the Relief and all the other ships sailed away for 3 days to get away from the eye of the typhoon, because the eye was going to hit Okinawa. And it sure did. It did great devastation there. And we returned 3 days later. We went ashore in landing craft. You know, they put nets over the side. And we went ashore in landing craft onto the beach, and the Americans had very thoughtfully built a huge tented camp on the beach, so you didn't have far to walk. I've got photographs of this too, Conrad, and you just got off the landing craft, walked a few yards up the beach, and just occupied any camp bed you wanted in any tent. There was no question of segregating nationalities, ranks. You know, you could have a private and a captain and a sergeant and a colonel. You were all mixed up together. And the deal was, and there was a big mess tent and everything, and you could go along any time and have food, really. And the drill was that they'd converted every plane they could into a transport, the Americans, and they were constantly flying from Okinawa to the Philippines, 900 miles, or 1,200 miles, I've forgotten which it is. And there were a constant stream of American army trucks coming to this tented area, and over the tannoy system they'd rigged up, the public address system, they'd say another 30 or another 50 or another 100, and you'd pile into these trucks and be driven to one of the many airfields that had been constructed in Okinawa. And there you'd be taken to an airfield, no bullshit at all, no going through offices or anything. They'd drive you straight up to a plane, which might be a B-24 Liberator or a Dakota. Some flying fortresses, but mostly B-24s and Liberators and Dakotas. And you'd be just dropped off by this plane, and the pilot would be standing there. How many have you got? He'd say to the driver. 32. Yeah, I can manage that. Like, pile in. And you just piled in. No nominal roll taking or anything. You just piled in, and he got clearance from the tower to take off, and you went to Manila. Well, you went to the Philippines. So I was in Buckner Bay for a couple of days. I did a bit of wandering around Okinawa. I got a ride in a Piper Cub of a local American Army unit to go and view the battlefields of Okinawa from the air. Jeeps galore. There I saw my first Bailey Bridge, because the Bailey Bridge was heavily used in Okinawa by the Americans. And of course, it was designed by a man here in Sandbanks Pool and built at Christchurch, 10 miles along the coast from here. The Bailey Bridge, that's the way it was developed, at the military establishment at Christchurch. But finally, I got on a truck and I went to the airfield with a crowd of others, and we got on a B-24. And I sat in what had been the rear gunner's turret. In order to lighten these planes, the Americans had taken off all the armament, everything metal that was surplus. They put wooden planks across the bomb racks and just tied them on with string. The pilot said he'd take 33, and there were 33 of us on this plane. And we flew down. We were destined for Manila to Nichols Field, which is near Manila, but clouds covered the field, so we landed at Clark Field, which was a gigantic super fortress base, and we saw these masses of planes that had been used for the bombing of Japan. We got off the plane. The Americans there offered us food, as much as you could eat. You know, the usual American food, hot dogs. They got donuts there by the Red Cross and coffee galore. Then a crowd of American Army trucks came, took us to a funny little railway station, and we boarded a funny little railway and travelled about 60 or 70 miles, by which time it was dark, to the outskirts of Manila. Clark Field, by the way, is still an American Army base in the Philippines. And we got to this little railway station, lovely little wooden coaches, meter gauge railway. And there was great singing, and we were all so loaded with free fags they kept forcing on us, fags and chewing gum and chocolates and candies, and you name it, we were being given it, and all excited at getting another stage on our way home. We got another lot of army trucks at this railway station, and we were taken to what was the 5th Replacement Depot. It had originally been set up as a replacement depot for American troops to fight the Japanese, to feed them in from the Philippines to Okinawa, Iwo Jima, and it was to collect troops for the invasion of Japan in November 1945. But they'd converted the 5th Replacement Depot into a reception area for British and Australian and Canadian liberated prisoners. And the 29th Replacement Depot, which was its fellow and just over the way, was for American liberated prisoners. It was a smaller camp, but they weren't separated. You know, there was a fence, but you could just walk through the fence. I know the second night I was there, there was a great event. They had a huge amphitheatre, natural amphitheatre, which the Americans made into a concert place, and they had a great, what the Americans call USO. England, it's the equivalent of what in England was ENSA. And the star attractions were Danny Kaye and Gracie Fields. And there must have been 10,000 people watching it, and I went along late. And, you know, Gracie Fields and Danny Kaye came on the stage together, and they looked about as big as matchsticks. But some people who'd been at the front, if you'd have told me it was Maurice Chevalier and Queen Victoria, you could have fooled me, because I was such a long way away. But they got amplifiers, you could hear what they were saying. And I asked some people who'd been in the front, who I met later in the camp later that night, and they said, oh yes, it was Danny Kaye and Gracie Field. And anyway, hung around there for a while, and you were dealt with there alphabetically. And finally the afternoon came when they announced over the public address system. By the way, we were there handed over to the Australian Army. It's the first time the Americans didn't look after us. They looked after us for feeding and medical, but administratively, the Australian Army took us over there. Very generous. With British government permission, they issued us each with £2 pay. They couldn't issue us with more because they didn't know if we got any credit. We'd only been prisoners for 4 years by this time, of course. We'd been away for 4 years. And I was announced to be number 2 on the waiting list for the next boat. On the waiting list, not part of the compliment. And my friend Bowen, was number 4 on the waiting list. And my friend Bevan was number 3 on the waiting list. And I've forgotten who the other A was. Atkins. Anyway, quite early the next morning, over the tannoy came, would Atkins, Adams and Bevan report to the transit office, which was run by Australians and Americans together. And we went along there, having just had our breakfast. You could eat what you like all the time if you wanted to. And you had one bottle of beer a day free. And you could go out to camp if you wanted to, but you were encouraged not to. You know, you could feed yourself and everything there. And if you were sick, there was fine hospitals. So we reported to this transit office and they said, get your gear to get ready quickly. You're on the ship. You're taken off the waiting list. You're going on a ship leaving this afternoon. And I said, well, what about Bowen? He's next on the list. I said, well, can't he go? No, he can't. There's only 3. I said, look, how many are going on the ship? He said, well, with prisoners and American servicemen going home on a point system, there's about 1,700 or 2,000. I said, well, what's another bloke? He won't mind sleeping on the floor, or I won't. He said, no, 3, that's it. And he said, we're not the deciders. The US Navy tell us how many people we can put on a ship. So John, I said, John, hold on, there might be somebody who can't go yet. Stand by. So John packed his gear up, John Bowen, in case someone else dropped out, because people dropped out because of sickness recurring, heavy malaria or something. And then the Navy, quite rightly, wouldn't carry him on a transport because they hadn't got proper facilities for sick, or dysentery might recur. But it didn't happen, and we got on board all these American Army trucks. Before we left, it was quite a lot of British, this was. British prisoners of war. No American prisoners of war were being carried, ex-prisoners of war were being carried on this ship, just British. The Americans aboard were going to be servicemen going home after a long time serving in the Pacific. Before we left the camp, Archie Bevan, who was a captain in the Welsh Guards, he was made British commander. I was made British adjutant and paymaster. Anyway, cut a long story short, we wound up down in Midland Docks. We got on board this American transport, the USS General Howes, or to give it its full name, the General Robert Lee Howes. And just before we left, a group of 6 American Red Cross girls, all very attractive ones, joined the ship. They were the only women on board, apart from 2 nurses in the sick bay. And we set sail, with bands on the key playing Anchors Away and all that jazz, and Don't Fence Me In, the Bing Crosby tune, which is a very... apparently they played it to all the prisoners when they left. And we were due to sail to Honolulu, to Pearl Harbor, for refueling. But a few hours out of Manila, the same Manila Bay that I've recounted earlier this afternoon, I went in on board the Hioki Maru, just 16 months before. They found that one of these American soldiers, not an ex-prisoner, had hidden a monkey and had brought him aboard. And because of the quarantine regulations of America, he got to be put ashore somewhere. So they decided to punish the soldier for breaking the rules. So we diverted to the island of Leyte, which is where MacArthur landed in the invasion of the Philippines. And we went into the port of Tacloban, and one of the ship's lifeboats was launched to take the sailor, the soldier, and the monkey ashore to Tacloban. Well, that diversion altered our plans a bit because they apparently were planned to land at San Francisco on a certain date. So we didn't land in Pearl Harbor, which we'd been looking forward to having a sort of few hours ashore there, which many of the ships did have. We went straight to San Francisco, and we arrived in San Francisco in October 15th. Around, I could look it up, but about the 15th of October, in a great armada. All the ships converged on San Francisco, transports with ex-prisoners, ex-soldiers, ex-marines, ex-sailors being repatriated, and the mighty American Third Fleet with Admiral Halsey. They all arrived this day, and we landed at San Francisco. Then, very briefly, because the tape started to run out, you don't want to start another, we were put on an island in San Francisco Bay. The British Army tried to keep us there. The Americans didn't care what we did. We were in charge of the Americans, but the British Army were really diabolical to us there. They wouldn't pay us. They wouldn't do anything for us. I broke camp and I went ashore to San Francisco and phoned up every day to say I was still alive. Was I on a train? And we were there. I was there a week. And finally the day came when I was on the draft. There were drafts of 600 that left. The American railway system put together Pullman trains at Oakland, which is across the bay from where we were. It's all in San Francisco Bay Harbour. They collected these Pullman trains of 600 people, and you moved from Angel Island, Fort McDowell, by ferry to Oakland. You marched through the streets behind the American San Francisco Scottish pipes, boarded the train, and then you set off to cross the USA. Unfortunately, we did not cross the USA. We went as far as Chicago, and we stopped about 3 or 4 hours in Chicago because there'd been a dockers' strike in New York, and the Queen Elizabeth, which was coming for us, couldn't land in New York. It had about 12,000 American servicemen on board. It had to go up to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and land the Americans, and then they went by train to New York. And we diverted from Chicago to Toronto, Montreal, Nova Scotia. And we were there put on a great aerodrome called De Burt, which was near to the town of Truro, Nova Scotia. And we waited there for the Queen Elizabeth to arrive. And after about 4 or 5 days in De Burt, Truro, we boarded the Queen Elizabeth. And again, we were shabbily treated by the British until we actually threatened a mutiny. They wouldn't give us any pay. Although the rest of the ship had a lot of troops who'd been serving in America for 2 or 3 years, and they were loaded with money, and they could buy all the goodies that were on this Queen Elizabeth. But we finally got, they were very generous. They allowed us to have £5 each. But that was only after a radiogram to the War Office from the captain saying that he didn't want a lot of mutineers on his hands. We weren't nastily mutinous, but we were annoyed. And we landed in Southampton on the Bonfire Day 1945. And on the 6th of November, I arrived home at about midnight in Birmingham. Well, I arrived in Birmingham Station, midnight the 6th. But we spent our first night in England at the Great Transit Camp on the Common at Southampton.